I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Je me souviens tous les jours sur la scène quand j'étais nagé avec les bises. Quand nous étions comme les jeunes, comme les amis, comme les après-sexes. Maintenant, je suis seule. Maintenant, je suis seule. Là, sur le mont Femme. Mais je suis pleine d'amour et je suis pleine de vivre mes rêves, mes yeux. Je vois un mec qui a un livre sur l'étranger. Et maintenant il est seul. Maintenant il est seul. Là sur le mont âme. Là sur le mont.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Aaron Bresnitz, sitting here in LA with Helen Holliman, editor-in-chief of Munchies. And I say LA because the show's based in Brooklyn. You're based in Brooklyn. I'm from Brooklyn, but we're like, let's do the interview in LA.
Yeah, we're here.
We're here. Let's do it. Welcome to town.
Thank you.
You're in town because tonight, which will have already happened when the show airs, is the LA release of the Munchies Late Night Meals from World's Best Chef's Cookbook.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I heard writing your first book of any kind is like having your first child.
That is an understatement.
Except for you did it in 6 months, which would be cause for alarm.
Yeah.
If you were pregnant.
Yeah, that would not be good.
So how did you get your start in food? Where did you get started?
That is a long story. I don't know. I actually worked in the art world when I came to New York. And then sort of got this internship at Food & Wine magazine and sort of ended up getting pulled into the vortex of food and have kind of been in it ever since. But yeah, I've done a lot of different things. Everything from writing to cooking to being a truffle dealer.
Ooh. What was that like?
Very smelly. It's a very smelly job.
Yeah. So. And what year was this when you started getting pulled into the food world? And I ask in the context of, was food at the level of pop culture that it is today? So
no.
What year was this?
Ooh, good question. I think it was like 2008. So back, that was sort of right when, the way that I place it in my mind is, the New York Times came out with this article that was about the Brooklyn Renaissance of food. And that had everybody from, you know, Mass Brothers to the Frankie's guys to, at the time, Salvatore Ricotta, which I miss much. And
pre-Roberta's.
Yeah, well, it was right. It was like year one.
It was year one. But pre-Roberta's in the way that capital R.
Yes.
Let's say that.
Well, it was like when you would go to Roberta's and you would wait for 6 hours because all the waiters were stoned and, like, it was great. You know, it was charming.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was kind of right when Smorgasburg began.
Sure.
And so definitely not. Like, food blogs became... they were just starting out.
Yeah. You know? There was definitely a shift.
Yes.
In it. And so what did you see about that shift as something that you would want to latch onto? And it's sort of, in many ways, with Munchies and your long career, sort of have been part of help shaping.
You know, I think it was such a time where... I lived in New York for a year right out of college.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I don't know if I like it here. And I had finished this Food & Wine internship. So I went to the West Coast. I went to San Francisco.
Okay.
I was like every cliche food nerd who was like, I'm going to work at Chez Panisse in the kitchen, and intern.
They'll pay me in bread.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I got to San Francisco and they're like, no, we don't have any room here. So
like the whole city or just...
Basically,
basically the whole city was like, our restaurants are tapped. Yeah,
the mayor was like, sorry, there's literally no room. Go to Oakland. No, but I actually started working for a food blog at the time. It was called Eater. They had
just started.
Paolo Lucchese was their San Francisco editor, and they had just started doing it. And there were all these interesting things, like Meat Paper magazine.
Oh, I love Meat Paper.
It's like the greatest.
Legend.
Shout out to Sasha.
Yeah.
Miss you, girl. But yeah, you know, it ultimately, I came back to New York and I needed a job. And my sister worked at Momofuku and she said, hey, there's this girl that works in the office and she's opening a bakery. She needs help. Do you want
to? Just say her name. Just say her name. We love her here.
So Christina Tosi.
Hi, Christina.
Was opening a bakery. And
it's funny, the bakery never did anything.
I know. It really didn't
take
off.
Like, Milk Bar, just like, you just remember it.
Yeah, it was a drop in the bucket, you know? And it was a great example of your question, which is like, at the time, it was just this idea. And then all of a sudden, it became like this wildfire of connection to New York, and people from all over were really into it. And I think that that's what pulled me in, was actually working with people like Christina, and also kind of this magical moment in food where people started to connect with people in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being, because I started working in food TV in like 2001, and then by the time 2008, 2009 rolled around, it was like something was happening. And you just saw a shift. You saw people looking at food in the way they used to look at music and art and things like that. And I mean, definitely Roberta's, especially where Heritage is based, was like a real cultural point to it. But Vice where Munchies is based, has had a long time history of sort of being a disruptor in that category, whether it's news, it's art, it's fashion, or something like that. And I know we're jumping ahead a few years, but when did they start putting their eyes, when did you get involved on food?
So Munchies used to be a show on Vice.com, a video show. And basically the premise was really simple. We would take a chef out on the town for a night. They would take us to their favorite restaurants and kind of eat and drink their favorite foods. Mm-hmm. And along the way, probably three or four restaurants in, they're probably a little bit drunk from eating and drinking. And they go back to their kitchen and cook a meal that we call the Munchies meal.
Sure.
This was you know, before my time, for sure. I think it started in 2010, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I should know that. I'll fact check that.
It's fine. We'll fact check. We're not, you know, Snacky Tunes has never been known for, it's like rough facts.
We're just, yeah, in loosely terms. But yeah. The first episode was with David Chang. And
again, some guy who just never...
Yeah, he never took
right
off.
Right off the cliff, right?
It's really strange. But yeah, so, you know, that first episode, if you watch it, I remember it.
Oh,
what's
yeah.
What's happening here, you know?
The fried chicken, Mad for Chicken. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I went out for Mad for Chicken because of that episode and being like, what is this place?
Well, it became the type of thing where in the second season, Chris Grosso, who is now one of our two executive producers at Munchies.
Shout out to Chris.
Shout out. And Lauren.
Shout
Cinnamon,
out to Lauren.
You know, really took it over and made it what it is. And so ultimately, about 4.5 years ago, actually longer than that, 5 years ago, Chris and Lauren went to Shane Smith and they said, hey, we've noticed that like this show does really well. We actually want to pitch a food website. And Shane was like, great, go do it. So that's where they found me. And so I was hired to create Munchies, the website. So now we've retitled
the whole
thing. Show to Chef's Night Out. And sure. Now Munchies is a global food website, and we are in 8 countries worldwide.
Incredible.
So, yeah.
So, let's talk about Chef's Night Out, because that was really the heart and inspiration for this book. I know you mentioned the first episode of David Chang, but boil it down a little bit more of, like, what people can expect from what is now 130-plus episodes.
Yeah, we actually have over 200, which kind of makes my brain hurt because it's so much content.
It's
that
over
I
200.
Yeah, it's like hard to keep track. It's amazing. We've filmed all over the world, from Japan to Mexico City to Toronto, you name it. And a lot of people ask me, like, why did you guys go from, you know, Vice is the disruptor, like, why would you go to print and like make a cookbook?
Yeah.
And I think we're living in this golden era of cookbooks, because cookbooks are now about storytelling. It's
Absolutely.
Not just recipes, you know? So for us, like, this cookbook is really this beautiful combination of recipes that really showcase the personalities of really like the some of the biggest chefs in the world in a different way, and what they actually like to eat when they're not cooking for their restaurants. But it also includes like funny experiences from the show. Like my favorite thing, you know, Daniel Patterson of Qua, like, he's obviously one of the greatest chefs in America, who's very
buttoned
kind
up.
Of buttoned up.
You literally clutched your buttons.
Literally
had to clutch your buttons. That's how buttoned up he is. No, when you think of that, you think of, like, we are in for a very formal type
yeah.
of meal.
It's very, like, chef's table,
sure.
you know, elegant. And so, you know, a lot of times chefs come on the show and they like to get rowdy and be really memorable. But for Daniel Patterson, he took the opportunity of the show to actually take his wife out on a really nice date.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, his...
He's like, babe, we have a night off and someone's going to pay for it. Let's go on a date.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she was like... Like, the two of us? She's like, no, there'll be cameras there, but...
Yeah, exactly. And they literally... So they went to 3 restaurants, and at one point, one of the chefs comes out and, like, brings this plate of food, and he goes, you guys aren't drunk. Like, what's going on? And he's like, well, I don't know. We're just having dinner. And he's like, I don't know. It's weird. All I can do is, like, talk about our children. Like,
yeah.
What can we... So... The section of the book, we actually pulled all the YouTube comments
yeah.
of, like, what people said about it, because it's just the funniest thing. And it's this great kind of reflection of what Munchies really is, which is about like personality and kind of cutting through sort of what I sometimes like to call like the PR veneer of restaurants, you know?
I mean, because it's Vice, because it is a longer format, because it is, well, web, and now it's also TV, not to diminish it, because I absolutely have loved and made a career of digital-based content, but does that allow chefs to open up in a way that they may not for other networks, or have an opportunity to for other publications?
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately, everything that we do at Munchies, we try to be honest, mm-hmm. and we try to make everything feel connected to people in a real way. You know, the Vice audience isn't necessarily a food audience, and the food audience isn't necessarily a Vice audience, but it's really kind of that conversation at the table, if you will, that they're having together.
Oh, yes, the table, the great big table of pop culture, yeah.
But that connective tissue is, I think, what Munchies is. So, like, the Vice audience might not know who Daniel Patterson is, but they enjoy the entertainment of what's happening on that episode, and so... Yeah, to your question, I think Vice as a whole goes to places that others don't, and they try to represent, I don't want to say like subculture, but kind of the stories that others aren't telling. And I think, you know,
I mean, I'll say it if you don't say. I mean, Vice to me has always been about subculture, which is interesting because food I no longer really consider a subculture, and I will never ever call chefs rock stars, but I'll call them like pop culture icons. I'll call them artists in their own sense, which I think you guys celebrate in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like 10 years ago, I remember, and you remember it, that article that was like, chefs are the new rock stars that Kim Severinsen wrote, mm-hmm. and I was just, we were all like, no, Kim, why did you say that?
I know. I mean, we got, because obviously this is a show about food and music, and so we've been asked that question many a times. And I go, you're asking the wrong question. You know, the question really is has food reached a level of mainstream status and relevance that has been given to music, art, sports, et cetera, and things like that? Which you guys helped do on Munchies.
I mean, I always say this. It's like if you think 100 years ago, people used to dress up and they would go to the opera.
Yeah.
You know, they would, that was like a really big night out. And I think now for young people are doing that, but with food. Food is sort of like this last downloadable thing as an experience that even with music is becoming a different scene. And I think that ultimately that's what I find so exciting about the future of like the food scene is that
you still have to go experience it.
You got to go out in the world.
You got to go out in the world.
Until we become robots, you know?
Oh, yeah. But that's like at least 4 or 5 years away.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're going to take a quick break. I want to get a little bit into the studio and the garden. And then obviously to talk about the cookbook and some of the awesome things that are in there. We're going to take a quick break. We have a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I just want.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Helen Holliman, editor-in-chief of Munchies, co-author of Munchies Late Night Meals from the World's Best Chef's new cookbook. Shout out to JJ Good.
Shout out.
Who's your...
What's up, boo?
Co-author who couldn't be here. So, you know, I've been a fan of Munchies and the programming you've done for a while, but one of the biggest shifts I've seen from your stake in the game is when you rebuilt a studio and built a garden. And I felt that that was sort of, we're not going anywhere. Like, in fact, we're, like, quadrupling down on what we have to offer and what we're going to say. Look for us here. Why did you do that? And what have you seen the results or the shift in perception about Munchies since you've built the new studio in the garden?
So when I started at Vice, yep. We had 80 people in our office space.
Total.
80 in a very intimate and cozy.
Oh, I remember it.
You know how
I know
it was.
I know
it was kind of like a shoebox, mm-hmm. because we were growing so quickly. So we had to relocate, obviously. And now we have 1,000 people in the office that I work in. That's just in one office, right? We're in 32 countries worldwide at this point. So when we were thinking about this new office space, the idea of creating a test kitchen became really paramount, I think, not only because Shane could potentially have a wine cellar in it, but
of
also...
Of course. Let's talk about the real reason, because the house is not enough, and you got to have the wine cellar in the West Coast.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. You know, it's like, he loves wine. I love wine. We get along.
And maybe
great.
A bottle of one or two goes missing during a shoot. Yeah. It just happens.
It just happens. You know, we don't talk about it. But, you know, it became this type of thing where it's like, well, this has to be the new incubator. We have all these incredible people coming through this office at all times. Why not make it actually a shooting space where we can also have dinners, we can recipe test. And so it kind of became our Willy Wonka lab, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process of building the test kitchen, you know, we had a architect who has never worked in a kitchen. And my publisher, John Martin, and myself kind of looked at each other.
Ooh, John Martin, shout out. I love you, John.
Wish he was here today,
I
but
know.
He's in New York making us money. So thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
But we sort of looked at each other and we were like, we need a chef to actually look at this and make sure that we are on the nose here. And so we ended up asking Tin Ho, who used to be the chef de cuisine at Momofuku, Sambar, and Mapesh, who's a good friend of mine. He looked at the plans, ripped them up, and redid it all.
Good.
So...
take everything you know, throw it out.
Yeah, and that's that's what he did, and we ended up having this really beautiful kitchen space that is more useful than ever, because we shoot a lot of video in there. We've done a show called Moltissimo with Batali in there.
Again, you just find these guys whose careers have, like, fallen off, and, like, you revive them.
It's wild.
No. But, well, I actually want to talk about that because... in many ways, having Batali with the show on Munchies is some, like, very weird, I can't say, like, full circle, but a very amazing thing where he was one of the original faces of Food Network and then left because he's like, I still want to do real food. And they were like, fuck no. And not only does he have a show on your channel, but he also wrote the opening the foreword for the book. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how that relationship was established and how he came to essentially introduce the world to your first cookbook?
So, we had shot a pilot with him for what would then become Moltissimo. We shot it with him and Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang from Master of None.
It's a good episode.
And it's literally just called Master of Lunch. And it was sort of like, what if we did Molto Mario 2.0? Yeah. But we sort of infused it with Vice characters and, mm-hmm. and different cultural figures. So he came out onto our rooftop garden,
mm-hmm.
So I took him around and I kind of showed him all that we were growing, because it's really sort of a farm. And there was just this synergy that happened between him and our entire team. And that's sort of the moment, I think, that he was like, hey, I really trust you guys, and I'd love to kind of collaborate and really see where we could go with this show. So we started doing that. And in the process, he's become not only an amazing friend of our brand, but like I think a really important part of what we do moving forward as well.
I mean, it's good to have someone who has such good working knowledge and perspective, like real perspective in that industry of like how to navigate the do's and don'ts of, or just offer us some counsel.
Well, I think the thing about Batali, whether you realize it or not firsthand, like what is so remarkable to me about him is he's the most knowledgeable person in a way that you can literally pick up. Like I showed him Wormwood and he literally just started rattling off this historical, you know, archaeological type facts about it. And that is rare. And I think that when we look at like young chefs who are kind of becoming very well media trained, they're not, his brain is an amazing resource and they don't come like that often. So
especially when you stray from the talking points and you're like, just talk to me, just say whatever that's not in like the 8 bullet points that's in front of you. And they're like, marinara sauce. But having him write the open, and I guess going back to what you said about trust, you know, Chef's Night Out and the book itself really does have this trusting relationship, I think, between Munchies and the chefs. Because the show and the book could easily be, like, showing them at their worst, really putting in all the bad. I mean, not all. I mean, there's some funny moments in there. But, like, you could really exploit them and the show would have been over and things like that. But to have 200 episodes, to now have a cookbook, speaks to that trust between relationships. So when did you see the shift between chefs and Vice saying, like, we're serious about food? And then when you started to approach them about the cookbook, they were like, we're totally in.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, so year one and to year three of shooting Chef's Night Out, like, it was a struggle to get bigger names on the show without having to explain to them.
Even with Chang being the first one?
Well, he was like, why not? It's a thing with Vice. Let's see what happens.
Sure.
But once it was sort of established, there were certain personalities that we thought, oh, like, let's try to get so-and-so, and it was really tough to sell. And now it's the exact opposite, where we're getting very big names. They don't know anything about Vice or Munchies, but they've heard of Chef's Night Out. And I think the thing is that since Kitchen Confidential came out, there's nothing else that really, like, showcases what it's actually like to live and breathe restaurant culture.
Sure.
And this show is really that. So I think for even kind of well-media-trained chefs, it's an opportunity to let their hair down, show that they're actually more relatable than they might present themselves on, like, morning television programming.
Right.
And I think that that sort of idea of the trust thing, we only, you know, it's like the camera is truer than anything in a lot of ways.
Of course.
And it's what you decide to present on camera. You know, it's not us being like, we're going to turn you into a monster. It's like, great, we're going to take you out. The cameras continue to roll.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know? So, like, it's up to you to paint whatever picture you want.
But there is a certain level of trust with them being like, you're not going to make me, if I am a monster, you'll, like, maybe look at least, like, a cuddly monster.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask Chris Grosso, there's definitely certain people who I think probably went off the rails. And we've done a service to them by not including a lot of what didn't make the, you know.
Do you have any stories you can tell? No names?
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, there's definitely people who I think because, like, Fernet is a really kind of big character throughout this show. Like, that's why we have a DIY Fernet recipe.
Which is amazing. It's like right off the bat. It's like you're going to need, by the time you get together this cookbook, you're going to need just like a liter of Fernet.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's the sort of restaurant drink of choice.
Yeah.
And but there's definitely rivalries that we've seen, like, of people, like Eric Anderson, who was at Catbird Scene, was, like, you know, talking smack about the guys from Battersby. And he's like, they said that they could, like, drink a lot of Fernet. Well, I'll show them, you know.
Oof.
And, like, drank so much Fernet, like, more than we've ever seen in this show. That's really impressive. But I think that, like, that sort of,
like, that, oh, your episode was crazy, I'm gonna drink even more.
Yeah, people try to, like, one-up each other sometimes.
So in putting the book together, and I know a lot of it is inspired from the show, what was the idea? Because you could have taken your first cookbook in so many directions, and even the Munchie stuff you could have taken, so many the Chef's Night Out stuff, in many directions. how did you start curating it? Where did you start getting the idea? What was the process?
So, yeah, I mean, for us, I think this seemed like the obvious choice because Chef's Night Out was sort of the birth of Munchies as a brand. And so not only that, but we've done over 200 episodes. So like there's so much food on this show to choose from and it's so much amazing food. So in distilling that down, it was overwhelming because I basically had to break it out into the main categories.
Yeah. You just like, focused yourself.
I was like, okay, so the top category is offal. Like that was the most popular thing. People were like, I'm going to cook like face and tongue and intestines. And I was like, that's probably not going to sell a lot.
It's not
going to
sell cookbooks. Yeah.
But we basically broke it out and looked at everything and said, okay, we need to have a good combination of personalities, but also categories that really for the home cook are going to be things that actually work for them.
Right. And so what type of recipes can people expect? I mean, it's definitely late night food. And for those who don't, who are not familiar with late night food or was never like drunk at 19, like what can they expect from these types of recipes?
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely runs the gambit for sure. Yeah. You know, there's stuff that's very straightforward. Like Jamie Bissonette from Toro.
Shout out
to him. Made a very delicious and very indulgent thing, which is literally scrambled eggs with potato chips, which on the surface sounds really
awesome
and maybe like too literal for a cookbook.
Sure.
But
there's technique in there. Like there if you've never really scrambled eggs. No, but I'm serious. Like, you know, that's why the famous chef test is make me an omelet. Like eggs are.
Well, actually, I mean, the thing is, if you eat it, it tastes like tortilla española, which I think is the coolest part about this book. So everything in the book has this edge of chefy to it.
Yeah.
And there's recipes that are that easy to recipes that are you could make for a dinner party. Like we have a lot of really good seafood recipes in it that I
interesting. Late night seafood is not what I would put together, but I guess you know, maybe beyond fish and chips.
Well, here's the thing. It's like Batali says in the foreword. It's like these chef recipes, they want you to think that they went back to their kitchens.
Oh, yeah.
And took 2 seconds. But in reality, they thought about it and they want to impress their restaurant friends.
It's like, come back to my place. It's like a magic trick, right? Where it looks so simple.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, fuck. You're like really like, you're like burying us right now with like flavor and technique and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beyond the recipe, though, and going back to what you mentioned before, there are a lot of really good stories in here. Mm-hmm. Can you give a couple examples or one example of what type of stories people can expect that if they never turn on their oven because of this book, at least they're taking something away?
Yeah, so there's, well, it kind of, I'll answer it with a little bit of a combination, which is that this book has a lot of amazing illustrations in it from Justin Hager, who's this hilarious illustrator. And he actually watched every episode and would draw people. And one of my favorite illustrations that he did is how to drink vodka like a Russian.
Oh, it's so good. Shirtless.
Shirtless.
With the toes. Yeah. So good.
Alexei Zimin, who is a chef and restaurateur in Moscow, had a really interesting episode. And throughout it, I watching him drink vodka is a sport because I did that, I would end up in prison or I would be dead.
Yeah.
But he does it well. And in that process, he actually sings this really tragic song. And he's like, this is a classic drinking song in Russia. And anyway, you should read the lyrics. They're in the book.
It's great.
But it's, I think, a good example of learning who these people are without having to know too much about the inside baseball of the restaurant
or
world.
Read a 1,200-page New Yorker article that's very dry.
Yes.
So finally, you get the stories, you get the recipes, but what is like the most, now that you have the book, what's the most unexpected takeaway for you or for a reader, an insight that they might get from this book that they might not just get from the cover or from the press release?
I think this book is great for not just people who actually like eating food, but people who like to read. Mm-hmm. Because, there's definitely, again, the technique and the delicious factor for the recipes. But I think ultimately the storytelling behind all of the chefs who are featured in this book is going back to like our initial part of this conversation, which is that food is about connecting mm-hmm. back to people. And I don't know, personally, when I read about all these people, I want to hang out with them, whether I've met them or not. So
the show is just about being like, give me a call. Like, give me a call, I'll hang. Well, Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Such a pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
If people want to get the book, where can they go?
You can go to your local bookstore, or you can go online to major retailers.
Munchies.
Or just look for, it's called Munchies, Late Night Meals from the World's Best Chefs.
And if people want to watch the show or anything like that,
you can visit munchies.tv.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so
much. Have a great time at the event tonight.
I will,
We have another song from the archives coming up, and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Alex Rose, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you for having me.
Long time friend and hanger out at parties, first time guest.
Yeah.
I think our friendship is, you know, when people are just like, oh, how'd you meet them? And you're just like, kind of like, you're like, oh, around. Well, it's like,
we literally met around.
I had another friend a few years back that Jess Rotter, who used to be a Mexican Summer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now
yeah,
is Latin
yeah,
Attic.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
That we ran into each other so much that we were both convinced that we had each other's phone number and we had obviously texted each other to meet up. And then I was like, oh, hey, I'll call you. Then I had to get her number from somebody. I was like, this is... And I feel like with you, through Ben and Maggie.
Yeah, absolutely, through Ben and Maggie.
And then there was, like, that one week where, like, three nights in a row, and I was like, we should just, like, let's just call this a friendship.
Yeah.
Let's just...
I think we're friends now.
We'll call it
friends. When we exchanged phone numbers, I think that was the real just, like...
Oh, I still don't have your phone number. You can get it from me.
Okay.
But, I mean, exchanging friend phone numbers is still... I don't know, you're kind of good... Can I get your number?
I know, it's so dorky, especially because it's like, I don't know, because we like already had this like existing like foundation of friendship.
Yeah.
Then to sort of interrupt that and be like, yo, dog, I'm going to try to intentionally hang out with you sometime. Is that cool?
Yeah, is that okay? Because or it's like someone you see a bunch in like 6 months and you're like, fuck, what's your name again?
Oh my God, I know. God, that's the worst.
It's like,
I feel like
hey.
That happened to me last night, like... 4 or 5 times. It's just like, oh, hey, oh God, I've hung out with you like at least half a dozen times. I have no idea who you're doing.
Yeah. Besides being a new friend and totally rad and playing music, you have a good history, including radio, which is awesome.
This is true.
Let's talk about the show.
About Domino Records on Eastfield Radio. So the format was basically like, you know, obviously I played some, new Domino releases, and as well as from the Domino publishing catalog, which is pretty diverse. So I played, you know, a mix of indie rock and new shit that I really liked. It was kind of all over the place. It was
that
like a bit schizophrenic.
Not that old.
Not that. I played that new and that old interchangeably. Like I'd play like Amon Duel 2, like then, you know, fucking Blood Orange.
They have that deep catalog.
They do have a deep catalog. I knew that I was forever maybe in the good graces of Jeff Conklin, who was a great institution at that radio station, when he came downstairs from the office and was like, are you playing Amon Duel? And it was just like made his day. He was like, I did not expect to hear that at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning. Like,
which is great, because you know when you like get like the GM or the running station who hears music all the time. To
absolutely.
Be like, I'm going to get up and go talk to.
Like that music, that station was just on 24/7 in that office. And the fact like it was very special. And before that, you know, I had a show. I had a radio show in college as well. One time I had zero listeners. It was... yeah. I could see the listener. I could see the traffic.
Just dropping.
I'm like, man, I really shouldn't have played that like UK subs song or like whatever I played. But yeah, so I did a world music and post-punk show in college.
Oh, amazing.
And that was really fun.
The only listeners that I was,
I was 100% sure I had were like the dads of students when I had a college radio show. This guy, Bud, would call every couple of weeks. He was like, his son ended up taking over my room when I moved out of my house. But like, I knew for sure that I had like the dad population cornered.
And which radio station was that?
It was KWVA. Okay. I had the new.
It was new.
It was like if it had been out for like 3 weeks, it was like old.
Were you tracking for the for CMJ and stuff like that?
Tracking for CMJ, and then also just like it was. I happened to be there like at the rise of blogs. That's when I was on. So like any demo that someone coughed out would just make it. It's like, yeah, we got like a 56 kilobyte rip, and I was like, that is great. We will put that on the air, and we will awesome. Yeah, we will. We would like rip songs from MySpace players to play.
Amazing.
Yeah. So.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shit that would not fly now.
Ripped
at all.
So many MP3s to play on the radio.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people do use Spotify and like other streaming services to DJ, and it you can really tell the difference. You know, like
you
what
can.
If the internet? What if the internet would? Well, I guess this is an internet station, so if the internet went down, we'd be fucked. But
yeah, I mean, there's a new. That new streaming service that's coming, that's like they're all the tracks are like FLAC funds, and it's like $20 a month.
Interesting.
So, you know, pick up your they're FLAC. It's like uncompressed. No, like you don't lose any audio.
Lossless. They're gigantic files.
Which is crazy that they're doing it streaming. So, like, I'm not really sure how.
How is that? Wow. Yeah, how's that going to work? That's amazing.
You need one of those college T1 connections.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need
all right, let's hear a song.
Yeah.
Okay,
forget,
sure.
Forget compression. Let's hear it live.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
Oh, what am I going to play? I don't think this song has a name. You know, some further background, I don't actually play shows or have any
recordings.
Which
is why this is so great.
So this is very special for me. I, you know, used to play the coffee shop circle in Seattle, which is very embarrassing. I can't believe I just said that out loud. So this is actually the first time I've played, like, just me and a guitar, maybe in six years.
Well, I mean, your biggest downfall is that you talk about it in your Instagram profile.
I will tell you, despite the fact that I don't play publicly, I spend probably an hour, you know, 30 minutes to an hour every day singing and playing guitar. It's just like part of my life.
I think you really downplayed it because you're like, oh, I don't know. And that opening song was great. So
yeah, I don't know why I wrote a song in French. It like came, I was drunk walking home from a bar, maybe like three or four weeks ago. Oh yeah. All of these are very new to, I don't know.
This is the new.
It's the new. I come from that like jazz improvisation mindset where I'm like, if you can't play it right the first time, why play it at all?
Okay. All right. So let's get.
Okay.
Well, let's call this track number one.
Oh yeah.
It's actually 2 weeks in a row where we have unnamed new stuff that's like just not named. So.
That new. Wow, it's really loud. I'm sorry, Liz. I'm going to turn this down a little bit. Okay. That suits me better. Is it too late now to change your mind? Do we have to go back inside? In this grand garden, there's no more malaise. So you come outside and pay me mine. And I will see what m'lady thinks, if she might call on me tonight. She is out of sight, you know I'm right. She is luxuries, she is dreamy things. She's a lady in the high castle, whose empire never ended. And I feel alive
inspired by some mad god, and I will arrive if she calls on me tonight. I hope she calls on me tonight.
Great. What was it like in the Seattle coffeehouse circuit? And what year was it?
God. And this was like 2007.
Great.
You know, pretty bleak. Lots of people tamping espresso drinks and...
Trying to think of a Seattle band. The Blood Brothers. Have you ever heard of them?
Wait.
I'm going to see them.
Who is it? I know they're doing that massive reunion.
Yes. I'm so excited.
I have tickets.
We saw them at... FYF, and they were incredible.
Really?
I mean, like, when we saw them, they played... I went to school in the Northwest, and they played all the time. They actually did my radio show in college.
Wait, where did you go to school again?
University of Oregon.
Okay. Yeah. I went to the University of Washington.
Mm.
Damn.
Get the fuck out of the station.
Damn.
They came on the radio show, and they were dicks.
They came here?
Oh.
No. When I was in college, I was so excited, and they were just dicks. And from, like, the first, like, 10 seconds, I was like, this is a... terrible idea. By the way, so 2007.
Yeah.
What was the any contemporaries?
I'm trying to think. I mean, this was sort of around the same time as Tiny Vipers, I guess, was kicking around. She was a solo girl. Contemporaries. I don't think any like big names really rose out of that. But sure, like, yeah, Tiny Vipers was, you know, she was signed to Sub Pop and put out some records and had a pretty small following, and I really liked her music. So I guess it was kind of like that. It was just like me and an acoustic guitar. The songs were very different. I mean, not that these are like very mature, but they were very adolescent and bratty.
Yeah. What was like a topic of the...
I feel like I was always like trying to come up with like clever ways to basically be like, I'm stoned, but in a clever way, and like sing about it and be like, oh, like I'm like, I think, oh God, I can't even believe I'm talking about this. I think I wrote a song that was like, I arrive red eyed, but ready.
Wow.
What the fuck? Wow. Why? Like, wow. No, just no. Yeah. I just look back on that. I actually don't even really remember most of those songs. I probably written, you know, in my mind, maybe like 40 songs. And I only kind of remember the ones I've written recently.
What was your knit cap game like?
My knit cap?
Yeah.
Oh God, I did. I had like a frumpy girl hat for sure. It was
frumpy
great.
Frumpy girl hat?
That's what my friend Luke calls them. Frumpy girl hat. I never thought about it, but I guess they are kind of frumpy. Like they're not like great. They were, you know, like those ones that sort of sit farther, a little farther back in your forehead.
Oh, I lived in the Northwest. You don't need to tell me about the frumpy girl hat. I was just kind of seeing if you subscribed.
It was great for the weather, though.
Yeah. I was like, oh, just throw this on.
Yeah.
If it gets a little wet, it's okay. It's like not that expensive.
Exactly. Yeah. And then your hair's kind of dry.
Yeah.
And you get
kinda.
To wherever you're going.
Yeah.
Dry enough.
Yeah, dry enough. The Northwest motto. Yeah.
It's dry enough.
Dry enough.
I'm not going to use an umbrella. God, why would I use one of those wonderful human inventions to stay dry?
Saying that you like play 30 minutes to an hour a day but not really playing, like what is the kind of inspiration for it? Or
when I was younger I used to sing in choirs and I did musical theater and stuff like that, so I think it's just a way to stay in practice. I sing in bands occasionally. I was a part of Household, which was a Brooklyn band. Played maybe six or seven shows with them earlier this year. So I kind of bop around. I prefer to sing, but I've spent so much time. I feel like it was like after I broke up with my ex-boyfriend like a year and a half ago. I live by myself now, and I'm like, oh, cool. This is like a practice space and an apartment. I'm bored. I like pick up a guitar and like.
Don't tell your landlord, they'll charge you more. Oh, yes, it's a practice space and apartment. We can charge you more for that.
Mum's the word.
Yeah.
Greg Flip.
That really is...
Put your earmuffs on. Yeah, wait, that's his name.
Greg Flip?
I definitely
and
thought he was a scammer.
And he's in real estate?
He's in real estate.
So what does he do with apartments?
Well, I'm sure he flips them, rents them.
There we go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it's short for Filipovich. Actually, my landlord was in a boy band in, where is his family from? Very small island from... anyway, on the opposite side of the world. I don't want to say Fiji, but where is it? Oh, well, I'm blanking on it. But he was in a boy band, and I looked up pictures on the internet when I Googled him to make sure that he wasn't a fake person.
Yeah.
Flip.
Darren just went through trying to find a new apartment, and
awful.
It was like two bedroom for in Williamsburg for $1,000 a month. Just wire me the money, and we'll send you the keys because I don't want to come down unless from upstate unless the money's not real. And that's like okay.
Sure.
I'm just gonna burn this. I'm just gonna light this on fire and send you a photo of this.
Seriously.
Why don't we get another song?
Sure.
Crank on. This is new part two.
Cool. I'll be in the box seat, starting the applause, starting the applause, starting the applause. So I better stop going, I better stop going, going nowhere, going nowhere but home alone again.
So you say Northwest. Are you from Seattle?
No, I'm from Austin, Texas.
Okay. Ooh, definitely. What's your favorite place to get Migos?
Ooh, that's a great question. Oh, I have an answer. there's a Migos taco at a window on Manor, East Manor. It's called Taco Mex. It's next to a laundromat.
Okay.
It's the best. It's Migos. Technically, it's Migos, so I cheated and answered with a breakfast taco.
That's fine. Yeah. That's still acceptable.
It's a good answer.
Cool. What about you?
Polvo's.
Oh, yeah. Polvo's is great.
Favorite, potentially favorite meal in the world?
Absolutely.
Polvo's, cheese, flour, tortillas, black beans.
Really?
Oh, my God. Polvo's is so good.
What do you want from me? I'm a man of simple tastes, you know? I'm just really comfortable with what's going on in my surroundings, and I just need Migos from Austin.
Anyway, I could talk. God, let's just talk about Mexican food for the rest of our lives.
Where's your favorite Mexican food place in Austin?
I agree with you. I think Polvo's may be one of my favorite places.
Boom. See you, Greg.
I mean, I'm not arguing.
What about in Brooklyn?
That's a harder question. Yeah. I don't have an answer. Honestly, it's okay.
I mean, there's you know where I wandered by that I haven't been in a while is Mexico 2000.
Where's that?
It's on Broadway. It's in the back of a bodega.
Oh, I've heard about this place.
Which has been around for a while. I don't know if it's, like, good so much as, like, it's cheap and it's, like, in the back at like of a bodega and it's
okay. It's
rad. It's next to Trophy Bar. Darren, do you remember? It's something like... Yeah, you
Mexico
took me
2000.
There. Yeah, you took me there.
Still around. It's a bodega. Yeah. It's probably... I wonder if it's good as I remember it.
Yeah, it could be one of those, like, it was good because...
We were broke.
We were broke, and it was down the street, and, like, just the location about it was great, but I'd be afraid to go back there, and it'd be like, oh, it's just not...
Oh, man. How many things are better in life because it's you're broke and it's down the street? I'm not just talking about food.
But
yeah.
Actually, there's a place not far from here where we are. I'm trying to remember the name. It's on Flushing and Knickerbocker. They have a great torta.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to that torta.
Shout out to that torta on the corner.
I think Free Williamsburg did a roundup of like the 10 best taco places.
And they only came up with 8?
No. There's a bunch of places. You have to go like one or two. It's like around these stops that the best Mexican food is in Williamsburg.
I heard recently that triangle space on Flushing is finally open. Did you hear about this? Mm-mm. The one across from Life Cafe? There's just that property that's a triangle. It's been there forever with like a outside space.
Oh, yeah,
Montana.
Yeah, yeah.
It's open now.
It's apparently. Not Montana's. They did. They opened a bar. I walked by it not too long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. They finally opened something there. That's crazy.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe we'll get a good roundup like for Mexican food in the coming. I just think it's impossible to have great Mexican food here. But that's just
it's hard. I'm actually, you know, I like La Superior. Come to think of it. Their new restaurant, I think it's called
Serviceria. Yeah, that's the one I was going to mention.
Oh, that's really
so.
Been
yeah,
there twice lately. Good deal, good prices.
It's good prices. Yeah. Like they have good drinks, good beers. It's all like imported beers from Mexico. And yeah, I would agree with that.
I live across from Loco Burrito on the Graham stop, so I can walk over there in my pajamas, just get a burrito, and
just
go back
close.
Home.
Close.
That's my favorite.
Change.
Yeah,
I remember when La Superior opened. I used to get in fights with the managers because they serve things traditionally. And they were like, I was like, okay, knife and fork. Like, that's not how it's eaten. And from where, like, from Mexico. And we're like, oh, I know, but I'm in the States. And we would get into, like, epic fights with them of their, like, toe the line. Like, just, you need to eat it this way. And I was like, I'm a messy eater. Can I have a knife and fork? So, but they're great. And their foods are awesome. I want to make sure we get time for one more song, but since you're not playing out that much, how can people potentially find you when you do like hop on
Cameo
that?
Friday nights,
secret vocals or guest shows or side
Let's
projects
see.
With certain John Chavez?
I do. I have a project called West Wing, and I'm mentioning it here so that it sounds more real.
Based on the show?
Neither of us have ever seen the television show.
All right. Perfect.
Well, is winter coming? Because
winter is coming.
Get those first four seasons. It's perfect.
Winter is coming, and that's when we will have band practice again.
Cool.
But, yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun.
Yeah.
This is really chill. We're just, like, eating pizza and hanging out in the back of Roberta's. It's awesome.
Yeah, today is, like, a good buddies type Snacky Tunes.
Yeah, shout out to Jay Strell, who's been our silent guy in the corner.
Yeah, I can't wait to drink this. Jay brought us homemade Negroni?
Bottled. Aged.
Barrel aged Negroni.
Oh,
yeah. Experimented with those.
The original Negroni recipe.
That's awesome.
Can take it.
Nicely bottled.
And then next week, I'll be gone for a little bit.
I gotta see who's on.
But we have Toy Cities on next week, which will be awesome. And Psychic Twin the following week, which will be great.
Psychic Twin will be a cameo as well.
Oh. She's.
That's with Black Kids. As
oh, right. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Look at that full circle.
She's great.
We'll be out and. Just want to say super excited for the Flyers tomorrow at the Garden. This is maybe the year.
Oh, man. And it's fall. I guess it was fall during last week's show.
Yeah.
It was really, not that you would know, but happy fall.
No, it's all reversing. It's summer right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, shout out to Cameo. I'll be there Friday night at 11:59 when the doors open for the late night. One more from Alex Rose. Take it away.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
All right, this is also, I wrote this last week.
New part 3.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I mean, all my songs are kind of rough and demo-y. See, this capo is amazing. Okay. I'm flesh. I'm business. Oh, touch me, I am sick. I am strong. I am lustful in this abyss. I am neither formed, I am not full. I'm a great divide, all is amiss. So kiss
kiss me, baby, while I'm wild and free. And tell me, Judas, are you my priest? Kiss me, baby, while I'm wild and free. And tell me, Judas, are you my priest? Open my mouth to impurities. Open my throat, let in the bees, so they can buzz and busy me. Tell me, Judas, are you my priest? Just kiss me, baby. And kiss me, baby. Kiss me, baby, while I'm wild and free.
We talk about food. We talk about music.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.